welcome to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are crashing through the airwaves with the brilliant assistance of OldFoolShirts.com. Well, with the international break depriving us of a game to talk about, myself and Alan Wares are delighted to welcome a man whose place in Albion folklore is assured. He made his name at West Ham and made, depending on Wikipedia, depends on how many appearances he actually made. It's either 300 or 239, but we'll ask him in a minute. But that was for West Ham between 1983 and 1992. He moved to Brighton, initially on loan in 1995, and went on to play 74 games for us. But he will be forever remembered for one goal against Bristol Rovers. And it's not often you hear his name mentioned without the prefix, sneaky. He's currently the interim manager of the Albion ladies team. It's George Parris.
Hello, mate.
Hello.
Welcome to this lovely, sweaty studio here at Abbey Road.
Thank you very much.
For those who saw the Facebook page from our last show last week, please don't think that AD does all his shows like that. He might be sweaty. We're fine. We're cool. George is, he's sitting next to me. He's the coolest man in Brighton at the moment. AD might be sweaty. Please don't have that in your head as you listen to the rest of this show. Don't switch off, please. But yes, welcome, George. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well.
Fantastic. Now, we do want to start your stuff at the beginning of your career, but every time we have a new person on, we do have to actually ask, what are your first memories, irrespective of everything else that's gone before or since? What are your first ever memories of Brighton and Hove Albion?
I suppose most probably playing against them when I was at West Ham. Mm-hmm. We came down on the South Coast two or three times, I think, and I think on one occasion, I think we actually got beat one of the games, a night game, if I remember rightly. So it was always a difficult place to come and play.
Yeah. Well, not least of which, because the pitch, as you found out later, was an absolute bog. And, you're always kicking down in the second half kind of thing.
Yeah, certainly a game of two halves. Yeah, there was a little bit of a slope on there, but yeah. We got used to it.
Fantastic. Okay.
Well, George, I've been doing some research into you this week.
We do research, do we?
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Oh, wow.
But and I'm not going to lie, my knowledge of you prior to doing that was a little bit sketchy, and it was pretty much mostly about that one goal against Bristol Rovers, but I've been digging into it, and your story is absolutely fascinating.
I suppose so, yeah, depending on what aspects you want to look at. But, I was a young lad growing up, born in Barking, a local lad to West Ham. Obviously, coming from background of a West Indian family, cricket was the number one sport in our household, to be honest. And obviously played cricket and football.
Who did you play cricket for?
Well, I played for my school side and I played for my district team. And I did go for Essex County Trials.
And what were you, a batsman, bowler? Or
at that stage, I was actually a bowler. So as time went on, I got used to thinking that's too much like hard work. So
so you were thinking, were you Michael Holding or Clive Lloyd?
Clive Lloyd, I think. Yeah. Definitely a Clive Lloyd, yeah. I potted up to the crease, but
I can actually see him, with the big floppy hat and the glasses. All
and the big afro, yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah. And then obviously later on, on my cricket front, I end up being a batsman, but
I can see him as Viv Richards, actually.
Yeah. Definitely
but,
so.
But I mean, you live in Sussex now, so I mean, do you get yourself down to the county ground and watch there?
I do. Yes, I've seen a couple of games. To be fair, I don't get down there as much as I should do because it's on the doorstep. So, I'm certainly going to try and get down there for a few games. Certainly the 2020 games.
So, when you say you're West Indian family, which island we're talking about?
So my dad was from Barbados, and my mum, Trinidad.
So in that case, in your household, did you have rival cricketing heroes?
I suppose so. I mean, my favourite cricketer was Viv Richards.
Yeah, because he's a Barbadian, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a fantastic player. But
that's where he's got the stadium named after,
yeah.
Isn't he?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, obviously that was the number one sport in our household. But right. Always used to go to bed with a football under my pillow, though.
Growing up, who were your footballing heroes?
I suppose footballing heroes, there was people like Graham Souness, Bobby Charlton. I mean, what a player he was, two-footed. And,
well, Graham Souness was certainly two-footed.
I mean, growing up
most of the time, yeah.
But growing up in Barking, presumably you were a West Ham fan.
Well, as I say, I wasn't really into football at that stage, a younger age group. It was only as time went on, and then obviously I've started training at the club when I was, I think I was 12 or 13. So up until that point, I wasn't really over keen on going to watch football matches.
All right, so was yours a football and cricket playing school, though?
Yes, yeah, we played all sports. I even tried my hand at athletics as well. So,
go on.
But I wasn't very good.
Track or field?
A bit of both. Long jump was decent, middle distance. I wasn't quick enough to be a sprinter.
So, I mean, it sounds like you kind of fell into football by accident then.
I wouldn't say it's accident. I mean, I suppose the crossroads was when I was 12 and I went for county trials at football as well as cricket. Mm. And at the time, I thought I was...
Was that the school like pushing you towards that?
The school nominated me. Obviously, I played for my school, played for my district, which was Redbridge. Mm-hmm. And then I went for county trials, football and cricket. And I thought I was going to get in at cricket, but I didn't, which... in hindsight, was the best thing that could happen to me. So I basically then pursued my football career.
As a kind of a cricket fan, were you kind of sort of, I don't know, crushed? Did you sort of, you know, sort of think, oh, well, you know, that's me done because I don't really like football kind of thing? Or
Not really. I mean, at that stage, I was heavily into my football as well. Mm. But I just thought, actually, I thought I was a better cricketer at that time, so... I chose the right decision.
It's a shame because, I mean, a few years back, I don't know if you remember this, there was a game of Brighton legends against Sussex.
Oh, they used
staff.
To do that all the time in the 70s. It was a pre-season charity match.
Yeah.
Because an ex-work colleague of mine used to play cricket for Sussex and used to play cricket against the likes of, you know, Brian Horton and Mark Lawrence, and they all come out into bat absolutely terrified, having to face the likes of Imran Khan and Garth Larew, and you know, John Snow would bowl up and turn up as well. And
I mean, the particular game I'm talking about, we had a Brighton team featuring Guy Butters and Chippy and...
Well, with Guy Butters, you wouldn't be able to see the wicket.
And so. Danny Cullen, you throwing that ball at me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
it's like, but Guy Butters is actually really good at cricket.
Yeah. I actually saw this. I actually remember one time we are jumping ahead here. It was actually a charity game that Sneaky played in at Findon.
Yes, correct. Yeah, that's
and
right.
I think
yes.
I remember the likes of Ian Hart was hosting it, and I think even, you know, sort of somewhat randomly, Josh Gifford, the racehorse trainer, was there. But some of the ex Albion players. In fact, I do remember actually giving Dean Wilkins a bit of bird actually because. He was fielding out in the deep, legged it round. There was a shot played, whoever it was, I can't remember, legged
it
round.
Did he miss it?
No, he slid on. He slid across the boundary, you know, with his left foot.
Yes.
Stopped it, threw an absolute pinger back, and I just said something along the lines of, why weren't you that quick in your, or why weren't you that accurate in your career? I got daggers back. So
you're at West Ham, and you presumably you're making your way up through the ranks there.
Yes.
And you got given your debut by John Lyle.
That's right, yeah. So how it used to work in those days, as I say, I went to West Ham when I was 12. The famed academy. To be fair, I was one of the last in my particular age group that went to any pro club.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was there two or three years, and we used to train twice a week, Tuesday and a Thursday. And then in those days, we used to play only holidays,
right.
As opposed to now they play weekends. So... did that for two or three years and started to grasp what was going on. Lucky enough, played for England schoolboys, under 15s as well, which was a fantastic experience. So I had 8 games for the England side
then. Is that the ones where you used to always show them on World of Sport, live on World of Sport, England against Scotland at Wembley?
Yeah. I think that game, I think there was about 90,000 there.
Yeah.
Wow. And we got beat 5-4, if I remember rightly, against Scotland at Wembley.
That's Paul Ridout got
a hat-trick.
The one game that I ever remember of an England against...
Yeah,
and you played in that?
I was in that game.
Somewhere. who else was in that team?
Our side, I think there wasn't... too many that went on to play professionally. There was a lad who played at West Ham with me, Warren Donald.
Mm-hmm.
He played in midfield. I think there was a lad called Dougie McClaw who played, a few games for...
He's in
for
the Simpsons, isn't he?
for QPR.
Yeah.
Scotland had a decent side. They had Paul McStay and...
Oh, really?
Ali Dick, I remember.
Yeah.
There's some decent players at that stage. So sure. it was a great game, 90,000.
What were we talking about? 84?
No, that was 1980, that would have been.
Was it that far back?
1980, that
Gordon Strachan was probably playing for them, but then he was playing schoolboys when he was in his 40s. So
he was the mascot. But yeah. No, I didn't realise you played. Well, that's what happens when you don't do your research. I didn't realise you played in that game. Yeah, did you get any of your goals?
No, I didn't score that game. No, I made all. No, I didn't really.
I'll tell you what. You could tell us what happened, and we happily believe you.
I did score. I scored 3 goals in 8 games for England. So
fantastic.
That was good.
But I mean, West Ham is famously a club that really likes local boys coming through into the team there.
Yes.
So what was it like making your debut?
It was
at Upton Park, wasn't it?
That was Upton Park. So that was the last game of the 84-85 season. We played against Liverpool. And I didn't know an hour before kickoff that I was going to be playing. So it was obviously a bit of a shock, but it was a lovely shot to have.
How old were you at the time?
He said, "Oh, God, let's get." I was normally quite good at math at school, but I think I was 21.
Right,
you're born in 64.
Right. Yeah, so I've nearly come to. I was 21.
Okay,
was.
Yeah. And do you remember?
This is the last of the maths for tonight.
No, okay, fine. Do you remember who else was in the side then?
So our side, I think Alvin Martin played, if I remember rightly. Ray Stewart. Mm-hmm. I think Phil Parks played.
Because this would have been about the time that West Ham finished about third in the league, wasn't it?
That was the season after.
So we're talking about one of the better West Ham sides.
Yeah, I suppose
people
in
talk
history,
about,
yes.
You know, if you're talking about Brooking and Peters and Hurst, and what, fine, but and more fine. But, you know, this is the team that actually in the league, I think it had its highest ever finish, wasn't it?
That's correct, in league placings.
Yeah.
Speaking about all those players, I mean, what sort of a legacy was there playing when you got the likes of Bobby Moore and Jeff Hurst? I mean, did you feel any pressure coming through, especially in defensive positions like you were?
Yeah, no pressure really. I mean, they're great players. I think no disrespect, you're never going to be as good as them. So you just try your best and be the best that you can. So for me personally, there was never any pressure to get to those heights.
Sure. I mean, but like I say, I mean, I think there's probably one that you feel for yourself, but also, you know, the West Ham fans, but themselves would probably just remember, you know, only 15 years ago or 10 years previously that they, you know, they'd had that. But that said, you know, the old cup win, 75, 1980 aside, you know, I always sort of associate West Ham as being a side that always kind of, well, certainly in my early days of watching football, what seemed to be relegation fodder, always there or thereabouts around the bottom. You think, hang on, they've got some great players, they've got some, you know, a great team ethic, they've got the academy that plays this lovely football, and yet why are they so...
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
Was there ever consideration around at the time, you know, especially under, you know, well, Ron Greenwood and then John Lyle, about as to why that might have been?
I don't know. No, we didn't really look into it that much, but you're right, I suppose. I think from the outside, quite a lot of people used to like us playing. And if that wasn't your club, then they certainly try to watch our game. So there was always that tradition. Yeah,
sure.
Well, now, playing football around that time, it wasn't, shall we say, an enlightened era, shall we say.
Socially enlightened, no.
And you got quite a lot of abuse, didn't you?
Well, I got a bit, no more than any other black player around that time, to be fair. And I mean, my own fans, West Ham fans, were brilliant with me. I've never had any abuse from any West Ham fans. Obviously, we used to get some of that when we used to go on our travels away.
Sure.
It was a bit strange, really. Same being obviously a young lad as well. You just went out to play football. So, there's quite a few instances.
Looking back on it with 30 years hindsight, I mean, you'd look back on it and you're absolutely appalled. But, you know, at the time, like you say, you're the young lad. You have to go. You feel possibly you have to go along with what's being offered to you, and if that includes the slings and brickbats of, well, let's call it what it is, racist abuse. You've got to grow a thicker skin. You've got to grow a stronger and tougher mentality, and yet it's the likes of what you went through, even though you shouldn't have had to, you know, that's possibly sort of paved the way. I mean, do you actually feel in that sense any kind of, obviously you're not the first black player. I mean, you go back to the likes of Clive Best, who probably had to put up with
even more so. Yes, definitely,
you know, but do you actually feel a sense of, you know, sort of, well, we kind of opened the doors for you?
Well, you like to think so. I think the main thing as well with some of that is obviously the quality of football you played as well. I think if you're able to play quality football, then that was my thought, that actually that override what the fans were trying to do. I always used to take it with a pinch of salt, really, because I think, well, who is the fools? Because they're paying to come and watch me play. So you sort of like think, oh, that's interesting. But so yeah, you always used to give one or two things back to them as well.
Yeah, you were quite. There's been quite a few famous ripostes, as it were, that you had in the past. I believe there was one where if people were throwing coins at you, you used to try and put it in your shorts.
I used to pretend that I put it in my shorts, and depending on the how much it was, if it was only 10 pence, I used to throw it back into the crowd. So whoever threw that used to get a little bit of stick, yes.
But it must have been horrible. Sorry, I mean, I don't want to labour the point here and, you know, sort of come across a smack of any tokenism. I mean, you, like I say, you look back and you think, what kind of society was it back then?
Yeah, so I say, I think the main thing, I don't know if it was a little bit of ignorance from some people perhaps, but that was my viewpoint on it, same as... There was an instance, I think, when someone threw a banana on the pitch.
Danny Alves, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So
George had to put up with that.
So, yeah.
Well, George actually responded in exactly the same manner years ago.
Yes, which was. Well, I picked it up and then I ripped it open, pretending to bite it, and then I threw it back in the crowd. So, again, whoever threw it on the pitch, their friends were around and was giving them the stick as opposed to me. So that was my way of dealing with it.
Okay, but it was, like, at that time, I mean, there was, like you said, there was other players, and one other such player was, of course, Leroy Rossini.
Yes, that's right, Liam, Leroy. Sorry.
Yeah, I made that.
We've all done it.
I played with Leroy at West Ham for a couple of years, I think, and it was quite interesting now. Obviously, one, he's got the book out, and two, obviously, I remember Liam as a young lad coming down into the players' lounge, five or six, kicking the ball around after the game, so he's come a long way since. Yeah.
Sure, I mean, when knowing the Leroy Rossini you knew then, as, you know, when you were at West Ham, and the person who's become, you know, the pundit and the social commentator, you know, the chair of Show Races and the Red Card, and the book he's written, you know, It's Just Banter.
Yes.
I mean, does the person that you knew Leroy to be back then, does it surprise you as to what he's gone on to do now?
Oh, no, he was very determined. I mean, obviously, he had bad knees, Leroy, and some of the trials and tribulations he had to do along those lines just to keep himself fit to play. I mean, he was a strong character, so you knew he was going on to do bigger and better things. Yes.
But he's evidently gone on to tackle this kind of thing, you know, and his book is out, it's Just Banter, and it's... What is banter to you? I mean, we were talking about it earlier before we came on air, but what's banter to you?
Well, I think banter to me is if it's the two parties, or even more than the two parties, are laughing together. I think it's sometimes someone might tell a joke, and telling the joke to someone else, they actually find it funny, but other people around them don't think it's funny. So if they're involved with it, then that's not banter. So... That's my take on it.
Sure, but so taking that on board, I mean, you know, so we're not trying to labour the point here, but you know, you and others had to put up with that kind of twaddle.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, and to be fair, sometimes it wasn't even around us being black; it was other players that sometimes people perceive were overweight, so that they used to be called fatty, etc. So it wasn't just a colour thing, it was other people as well. So some people had to put up that for, or the other one, obviously a prime example was obviously Tony Adams being called Donkey, you know, that sort of thing. So,
well, during your time at West Ham, you have played with some pretty outstanding players. So who do you think...
Well, what's to say George wasn't outstanding as well?
Yes. I'm sure that's what they say.
That's
yes,
what they also
yeah.
I mean, they said that who about George.
I mean, who was the best player that you think you actually played with? Now, obviously, wasn't looking at the Brighton side you played with. It wasn't any of them.
Okay, forget that. Yeah.
Well, I suppose Alan Devonshire playing alongside him for the first team. I was obviously privileged to play with Trevor in reserve games. Trevor Brooking, Sir Trevor.
Yeah, he was an old man then, wasn't he?
Yeah, fantastic player. I mean. But I never played with Trevor in the first team. Then you had players like Alvin Martin, Ray Stewart, Phil Parks, Tony Cotty. I mean, I'd say I was quite privileged to play with a lot of good players when I was at West Ham.
You must have played with Liam Brady as well.
Played with Liam when he came back from Italy. So, I mean, judging by what a player he was when he came back to Italy, he must have been even better than that when he left, because he was out in Italy for eight or nine
years. I do remember a game, and I'm pretty certain that you played with it. It was at the Goldstone, where you, both yourself and Liam were playing against us.
Yes.
And we won.
Yeah, I think West Ham got beat 1-0. I think, was that when Budgie Byrne scored? Was that the sort of thing
that Budgie would do?
Yeah.
Does this mean, unless my timings are completely out here?
That was 1991. That was because we were. Was that 1991? Or it might have been 91. 89,
was a little bit later.
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, I get lost in those days. I mean, to that point, I'm probably going to, you know, someone who would know the answer. Did that mean you also played alongside Chris Hughton at West Ham?
I did, yes. Chris came, he played about a season and a half. He came to West Ham. That was around the time when
full-backs, weren't you?
Yeah, well, at that stage, I was playing midfield. That year, we got through to the semi-final of the Cup.
Right.
When we got beat by Forest. Less said about that. Controversy. But yeah, obviously Chris was a great player at West Ham, and obviously he's gone on to bigger and better things, obviously, as a manager.
Sure. Well, I mean, as something for you to emulate as you crack on.
Yes. You never know.
Never know.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't at
Whitehawk,
was it?
No, he wasn't at Whitehawk. I had a couple of seasons.
What do you remember about sort of Chris Hughton, the player? I mean, obviously the player on the pitch, but the fella off the pitch. You see a fella who's doing what he's doing off the pitch as manager.
Yep.
Is that tie in with the Chris Hughton you knew as a fella who was a teammate when you weren't playing, you know, the man?
Yep. Oh, very much so, yeah. Precise, to the point, quiet, but you knew when he was annoyed, or you knew something, there was an issue that he would address. So I'm sure that's the case now for the players, that I think they understand when he's not pleased with something.
Well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Eddie Packer. I'm here with Alan Wares and the wonderful chap that is, of course, George Parris. I didn't use a sneaky. I didn't use it.
Yes, you did.
Does that bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I think there's obviously a good side of it. I think obviously that's people remember. Yeah,
you've always got to have one sort of at least one thing in your career.
We're going to talk about the goal in a minute, but first we have got a shirt of the week, which I'm just going to pass over to George. If you could just describe.
And for those who've never listened to this show before, our show is sponsored by oldfootballshirts.com, and we do thank Phil and Mark Shelley, two brothers who run the website, very much indeed for their ongoing support. Thanks, guys.
And if you've got any shirts, it doesn't sell anything, you just take your picture of them and put them up.
Right, George, describe what AD's just given you.
Very colourful, green and white. Is that a caterpillar?
It looks like
two caterpillars together.
Mating.
Yeah. What language do you think I've got to speak today?
The other thing is that Phil likes to give AD any tongue twisters. I mean, he's bad enough in English, but to give him something that he can't understand or read. Right. So do you have any idea where that shirt would come from?
I would hazard a guess, Ireland.
Okay, can I have a look? I'm going to see if I can just read that badge.
I would say you're quite a long way.
Oh, okay, there you go. Okay,
it's green.
It is green.
It is green.
Do I need to put my glasses on?
No, I'm taking my glasses off to read it. I'm going to say it's something either, I think it's either Greek or Cypriot, isn't it?
I can't see. I didn't realise I had to read that. I definitely need my glasses for that. So.
What's Uncle Phil giving us this week,
that's
Adrian?
That's my excuse.
Well, let's think high. What's the highest?
West Brom. No, highest what? What city or highest?
Hibernian.
It's Bolivia. Is
right. So okay, fine.
So okay, so I would never have got that.
La Paz. Something in La Paz.
It's not actually La Paz, actually, but okay. that is the highest.
Highest football team in the world, is it? Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I picked this as it's a striking look, says Uncle Phil.
Yes, it is.
It's certainly not an off-the-peg template design, which he might mention once or twice. This is the 2011 home shirt of Bolivian side Oriente Petrolero. Of course, you'll want to know where they play. Well, that is the Estadio Ramon Tarucci Aguila Costas, which they ground share with Club Blooming. I can cope with that bit. And it's located in the city of Santa Cruz, which has a capacity of 38,000. With regards to nicknames, they have three, which is the first one is Albiverdes, No idea what that means, but well, it's some reference to the colour green.
Yeah.
The verdolagas, which is a plant also known as Mexican parsley. More accurately, it's a succulent plant called purslane, which is well known as a health food, apparently. And the finally, the last one is the refineros, which is a reference to the oil and gas industries, which form a significant part of the region's economic strength. There you go.
So we've got a social economic history of some team in Santa Cruz in Bolivia.
And
and he has no idea whether it's a green or green shirt or not.
Yeah. And the full translation of the club's name is the Eastern Oil Men. There we go. Thank you. Thanks for that,
Phil.
Well,
them and Canvey Island then. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now, cheers for that, Phil.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, George, we did mention Leroy Rossini's book.
We certainly have.
Now, you also had a book out, which came out in 2005, so we're probably a bit late plugging that one now, I reckon. But
I'm sure it's not out of print yet.
Yeah. But it's your autobiography, and it's a fascinating story. And you called it, My Name is George, I Am a Compulsive Gambler. Now, that links to, I believe it's from when you left West Ham to go to Birmingham, is that correct?
Obviously my gambling, I was gambling before I left West Ham to go to Birmingham. Mm. But the reason for the book was obviously at that stage I was in recovery from being a compulsive gambler. We did start the book, but actually never really went to publication, purely because I ended up having a relapse when in and around 2005. So we pulled the plug on it. But it was going to be around my early stages of me being a compulsive gambler. Although I didn't even know at that stage what that actually meant, if that made sense. Yeah. So
is it a kind of a culture that you have within your work or within your or stuff outside of football? What sort of led you down that particular path?
I don't know really. I mean, as I say, our background, West Indian background, was certainly my dad had his friends around. They played cards and they played dominoes or whatever. Sometimes
usually for matchsticks, wasn't it?
Yeah, it used to be matchsticks. Occasionally, they used to gamble and play with money. But
right.
we used to watch, and then sometimes we used to play. But that was me and my two brothers and my sister. So obviously, none of them have had a problem with gambling. So it wasn't hereditary, I don't think.
Because I mean, about that time, there was a culture of footballers who finished training. They'd go to the pub or they'd go to the bookies.
So. Yes, very much so. I think it was either go to the bookies, one or two used to go down to the pub, others used to play golf. So, that was the culture back in those days.
So, I mean, what was it that hooked you? What was it that was causing your problems?
I suppose, as you say, what initially it was just to go down to the bookies. There used to be two or three of us and used to put on X amount of bets. Problem I had, obviously, that they would go in and have one or two bets, and I'd be in there betting on every race that was being televised. So.
I mean, would you say you've got an addictive personality in that respect?
I think obviously around gambling, I certainly have, but I don't think I've got addictive nature apart from that. But obviously, it reared its head through the gambling.
I mean, I've seen it with other people as well, where you end up playing. You lose and you gamble more to try and catch up rather than just calling it quits.
Yeah. So the clever gamble, if you like, puts a couple bets on, and once they've lost, that's them done.
Mm.
Obviously, some people make a profession out of it, so they're the clever ones who are able to pick and choose what bet they're going to put on. But I wasn't like that, I'm afraid. I used to just bet on everything that moved.
What made you realise? Was there a particular instance, or was there a sort of a general thing that made you realise you got a problem?
I suppose at the time I didn't think I had a problem. That was the problem, that I didn't think I had that problem. So hence the reason why I carried on gambling to the extent that I did. And
what the time scale are we talking about here? From when till when?
My last bet has been, he said, trying to think now, February 2005. So obviously I haven't had a bet for 12 and a bit years.
But I mean, when did the sort of like the, it's got to start going from a flutter to a sort of a bet to a compulsion?
Wow, good question. I suppose because we used to play, the other thing was when we used to go on away trips to, and this was either with West Ham or Birmingham or Brighton, we always used to play cards on the bus, and we obviously used to play for money, different games. So sometimes you play Brag or five card Pontoon or and all that sort of stuff. So it was always that culture.
Well, at least it wasn't strip poker. You know?
No, luckily, yeah. That would have been really interesting on a coach of men.
But, at which point you wouldn't have had a gambling problem. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't have had a gambling. Yeah. I might have had another problem. But
you said you went to Gamblers Anonymous. So somewhere down the line, you actually got to realise that there was an issue that needed resolving.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think the issue was when I then started to try and get money any way I could for me to have a bet. So that's a major issue. So
do you feel that people need, did it get to the point where people needed to point it out to you rather than you, the sense of self-realisation?
No, I mean, the first time, it happened, I don't think I just had to stop because I couldn't physically get any more money. I'd exhausted all the funds. I begged, borrowed and steal for everyone I could have done. And it just got to that stage where I didn't have any money to then have a bet, so that was certainly the first time that I stopped gambling. And then I stopped for I think three or four years, and then for whatever reason, and then I had a relapse, and then went back in there at the same level I'd finished. And by the time those 3 or 4 years, I'd saved money. That soon went.
So how long was the relapse? I mean, was it sort of like a quick flash, or was it...?
It was over a two and a half months period, really.
Right. Now, you mentioned Tony Adams earlier, but it was Tony Adams and Sporting Chance that helped you out, is that right?
Yes, they did. So not initially, because I think at the first stage of my gambling, the Sporting Chance wasn't there, so I think it was later on. I did go in there. I went in for, I think it was 28 days, I think, just to try and clear my head, etc., and get back on the straight and narrow. So,
and it obviously really helped.
Yeah, it definitely helped me, yes, yeah. I think I came out and had to address issues and ultimately obviously try and stop gambling.
Yeah, and another person that really helped you was your wife as well.
My wife, or my ex-wife helped me, and that may be part of the reason why we obviously ended up getting divorced. But I've got remarried again, and obviously my new wife understands the situation and being very supportive.
I mean, you obviously must feel a much stronger person now.
Oh, definitely so. Yeah, I think it's quite interesting because I'm trained to be a counsellor.
What aspects of counselling?
I'm on my diploma at the moment, so. Once I pass that, hopefully in 2018, then I'll maybe have a look and see if...
Does that mean we can call you Dr. Sneaky George?
Not quite. When I say aspects of counselling, we're talking about sort of addictive personalities, or we're talking about alcohol-related? Or
Initially, the diploma looks at all sorts of counselling, but obviously in time, I might then specialise in one particular field, so...
And what aspect of it is it? I mean, you know, sort of, are we talking about sort of person-centred counselling?
Yeah, person-centred, yeah, so PCA, yes.
Carl Rogers and...
That's him, the one, yeah. You know, more than me.
But yeah, okay, so, I mean, you made a life-enhancing decision coming to Brighton. Now, when you signed for Brighton,
Did you realise the mess we were in?
It was already a club in turmoil, wasn't it?
Obviously, I know Liam, obviously, because I played with Liam at West Ham. So how it all materialised was during the closing, so when I got released from Birmingham, I went and played in Sweden for 4 or 5 weeks.
Norrköping?
Norrköping, yes.
Norrköping, yeah.
All right.
So within that, I haven't got the accent, but yeah.
You only played 4 games for them, apparently.
We used to play every weekend, so it was, I'd say I was only out there for 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, so... I did play every game, I think. So
sure.
I was out there, and obviously it was during the close season, and I was a free transfer from Birmingham. So when I came back from there, I think beginning early September, I think Liam gave me a bell, asked what I was doing. So I think I came down, played in a reserve game. I think there was a game.
Right.
He was just checking to see if I was still fit, etc. And sure. I came back down and played. I didn't actually sign my contract until, funny enough, after, because Liam then got the sack, didn't he? So yeah. I hadn't actually signed physically signed a contract until after.
So it was Liam that brought you here, but it was Jimmy Case that signed you.
Yes. I think it worked out. The date wise, that's what happened.
I mean, we're talking about sort of what you know as of Brighton from when we started off the show saying your first memories of Brighton. You remember playing for West Ham against us and what happened, yada yada yada, and. You know, the story of Archer and Bellotti and what they'd done to the club was just kicking in and what have you. So, yes, Liam's selling you the whole story. But, I mean, as a player, did you realise what was going on? Certainly before you signed. I mean, did Liam sort of point out, by the way, we've got a board of directors who really aren't facing the right way? And secondly, you know, as time went on, I mean, to what extent were you as a player aware and considerate of all the stuff that was going on off the pitch?
Well, yeah, you're certainly considerate of it because I think, to be fair, we had a bit of that when I was at West Ham, that there was the bond scheme. Mm-hmm. My time at Brighton, obviously, I was a little bit
older. Grief follows you around, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seems to be, yeah, the common denominator. But so I knew, obviously, and no disrespect, when fans are unhappy, then they're quite strong, aren't they? So you knew of that going on as well. So there was certainly that backdrop to it.
Can't help playing in an atmosphere that can be a bit poisonous, though.
Well, no, very much so. I think it's the old cliche, put it to one side and block it out. But, yeah, at times that is quite hard to do.
Especially when you've got sort of pitch invasions happening. You're trying to get on with your game. And,
yeah. You
know, I mean, from a fan's point of view, we can say that because of ultimately what happens, you think, well, the end has justified the means. But probably at the time as players, you're thinking, you know, well, because it did happen. One or two players did get sort of, you know, lamped and attacked. And you think, you know, but for the fact I'm a Brighton player, I mean, you must have had some concerns that, you know, at least if not one of your side, then one of the opposition was going to get, you know, one of your fellow pros was going to get.
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I think towards the back end of that season, I wasn't actually in the side, so I was in the stand. But, yeah, you're worried for your teammates because they're on the pitch, and obviously pitch invasions, you just don't know, do you?
Well, I mean, did you have any contact with the Uber Führer at the time?
Well, obviously, Bellotti was still at the club. I didn't really see Archer around, to be fair. So, personally, I didn't have that many dealings with him in my period of time that I was there. But you knew then that there was things bubbling.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was one of the reasons why Liam stood aside, so he could do something about it.
Well, I think it was one of those things. In a couple of weeks' time, we do have Paul Hodgson and Steve North, who are the co-authors of Build a Bonfire. And they will, I'll confirm it with them, but they did say that they interviewed Liam Brady in 97 after, you know, we'd left the Goldstone. And he gave, you know, his two-hour interview, got it all recorded and everything like that. And I think they could use, after the lawyers had actually finished with what he'd said, that they could use about three lines, I think I'm probably exaggerating a little bit, but, you know, the certain things that Liam Brady had to say about certain members of the board, you know, Paul and Steve would have probably got sued quite badly.
Oh, okay. Right.
If only there was a show at the Comedian on the 26th of April where we could talk about such things.
Yes. Yeah. So, were you, obviously, you know, Liam being, you know, the sort of like the, well, the not just the football man, but the kind of the socially aware fellow who, you know, like I say, he was the one who got Martin Perry and Dick Knight and everyone together. I mean, did you have conversations with him around the time, even though it was obviously a manager-player relationship, about what on earth was going on?
No, never did, to be fair. No, no. It was just, we had obviously a great understanding and that together anyway with the, as I say, obviously I played with Liam as a teammate. So,
sure.
But obviously I then knew that obviously when I came to Brighton, he was my manager and my boss. So
it must be a funny sensation, isn't it? You got one, the fellow, admittedly sort of like, you know, someone who's quite high up there in international standing, did well in Italy, played a squillion times for his country. You know, one of the greatest sort of players of his generation, who you're playing alongside as a teammate, and then sort of a few years later, well, this is my gaffer. I mean, it must be sort of like, well, where do I stand here?
Yeah. Well, no, I always knew where to stand, and I think Liam would say the same, that you don't cross that line. That he was a good teammate and stuff, but ultimately when I was at Brighton, he was my boss and I was his player. So.
Did you think he was a good manager?
I thought so, yeah. I mean, he wasn't here that long when I was here, so but yeah. I think obviously I've got huge respect for Liam.
So yeah, I mean, because his record managerially is not, didn't really... Well, it's not going to go down in history as being a success.
Well, let's face it. I mean, all right, it wasn't great at Celtic, but no one had a chance of doing well here. I mean, you could have had Alex Ferguson down here and he wouldn't have done any better, frankly, because, you know, everything was a complete and utter, you know, basket case of a club. And I say, when you've got one of the greatest footballers that Europe produced from the 70s and 80s, couldn't actually transfer his vast talents and knowledge and insights into an even a half decent side in the third or fourth division, you realise you've got major problems.
Okay, well, you had this beautifully, wonderfully cultured, amazingly talented footballer in the shape of Liam Brady. Who was replaced by George Pash. Who's replaced by someone who's probably the polar opposite to Larch.
A little less cultured sometimes.
A lot less cultured than Jimmy Case. Now,
someone who got to the cup final almost single-handedly.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, he was a talented footballer, but he was a destroyer, really, wasn't he?
To be fair, he was a decent player. I used to love playing against Jimmy because he was fair and he was honest. So you knew that if the ball was there, you'd both try and get it. If I kicked him, then later on he'd kick me and you have a laugh and a joke. So that was football, if that made sense.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You knew where you stood with him. Always a difficult player to play against.
Did he ever give you verbals on the pitch?
Not really, no. I mean, he did all his talking with his feet, to be fair. I mean, that's the sort of player he was, and I had admired him for that. So I knew that when we played against each other, it was going to be a tough game and no quarter given, and then you have a drink after the game.
Well, we're talking about that kind of thing. I mean, let's put it back on you. How would you actually summarise your game as a player?
I suppose, for me, I think I was a decent player. Always gave 100%. Always tried your best. Some days the best wasn't good enough, but I knew every game that I played, I'd come off the pitch giving 100%. I suppose people will maybe remember me as a tough tackling fullback, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer playing midfield. I thought I was quite decent on the ball. I could play one and two touch with the best of them. Not blessed with pace, so when I played as a fullback, I had to drop off and give myself a little bit of time to try and catch people.
Yeah, it's a good job you had Alan Devershire in your side rather than against you.
Indeed, yep.
I bet he was a pain to train against.
Oh, he was, yes, yeah, very much so. Yeah, I tried not to be paired against him, but I was very fit. I like to think I was one of the fittest in the sides. I was quite an energetic player.
Mm-hmm.
Scored one or two vital goals for different sides. So, yeah, that's how I would like to be remembered.
Right, talking of goals that you scored. Yes.
That's a nice segue there. Very nice.
Yeah, nicely done.
So let's rewind.
Right, okay,
October
hang on. No, in George's words, this has to be in George's words. It can't be us. We all have our own stories from it. I'm just wondering, you know, we showed him the goal again from Meridian or South Today or TVS or whatever it was back in those days.
Well, including an interview with him. And he was looking in the mirror, wasn't it?
George?
If only.
In your own words, George, talk us through it.
Yeah, so obviously playing against Bristol Rovers.
Yep.
I think actually at the time we were struggling and needed points. I think we were into the second half. Denny Mundy had a shot at goal, I think, from edge of the box.
Yep.
And I can remember myself and one defender running in to try and get the rebound. So I don't know why I was up there. I must have had a nosebleed. But So I was in the box, but goalkeeper saved it. And then for some reason, the defender turned and then ran out of the box. For some reason, I don't know why, because I thought I was going to get a nosebleed, I held onto the post, at which time the goalkeeper had the ball, but he obviously wasn't aware that I was behind him. And it was quite interesting because obviously the Bristol Rovers fans were in that corner and some of them started shouting, behind you.
This was at the south end, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But obviously the goalkeeper didn't realise that. So then he then went on to push the ball out of his hand. And as he did, he rolled it. And as he did that, I pounced from behind him.
Pounce, interesting word. Okay, yeah.
A fair shoulder barge. knocked him to the ground. I think took a touch and then deadly from 12 yards and an open goal. I just rolled it in.
You're saying now you reckon that nowadays That wouldn't be given because basically you flattened him.
And you think and you think it would be given?
I think it would, only because Glenn Murray did basically the same thing. Admittedly, George was slightly behind the fella rather when Glenn Murray against Norwich, you know, he knocked the fella over. Even then, the goalkeeper, whoever it was, the Northern Ireland goalkeeper when Murray was, you know, he sort of like turned around and sort of said sorry to everyone, knowing full well that he'd just been barged off it. Maybe it's a slight thing that because you went more into his back, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, every time I do see it, I think that's a foul.
Right.
I do think it's a foul.
But I mean, assume the referee didn't see it, and therefore, if he didn't see it, can't give it.
No, because, I mean, there's been various incidents since then. Bobby Zamora was...
he knocked out of a keeper's hand, didn't he?
Yeah, which is one hand that was given, and that has subsequently been outlawed. That's you're not allowed to do that.
So I was flying into someone's back, I think, as well.
Yes.
I know. But do you
remember what you actually sold TVS or Andy Stegall or Fred Dininger, whoever it was? Do you remember?
I just said, well, as I said, I said one, I think I can't remember why I was actually in the box, so that was the thing. And I said, once I'd done it, then, to be fair, I was waiting for the referee to say no goal, but I started celebrating and nothing happened, so...
Yeah.
And everyone started.
Do you remember the goalkeeper complaining about it at all?
I think the goalkeeper did more than anyone else. I think one or two of their players possibly, but didn't really make too much of a fuss about it.
No,
and let's face it, let's face it, George, you've dined out on that ever since, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. At least once a year.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I seem to remember seeing that goal again on Question of Sport and what happened next.
I think they used it again.
Now, if you've got at least one of those things in your career, then you can't have done that badly.
No, that's right. I'd rather have that than... A tragic own goal, perhaps, or something. So,
yeah, and Ian Chapman.
We need to get Hinch in, don't we?
Yeah, or Hinch or Ian Chapman. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Or Colin Hawkins. That'd be the best one.
Oh, crikey, but, yes. But you know, it's like I say. I mean, it's. I think that probably in asking you a few minutes ago how it is you describe yourself as a player who always gave 100%. I think it's fair to say that the Albion fans would be of a similar opinion. You know, like I say. With all due respect, can't see you as being blessed with pace.
No.
So happy, therefore, to sit in the centre circle and spray the passes around.
When I played midfield, yeah, for sure, definitely.
And, you know, like I say, with the occasional foray into the box now and again, and then forgetting to stop and actually just hanging onto the goalpost just in case he carried on to the south stand.
Indeed. I forgot to mention I'm two-footed as well.
Oh, yes. Not both at the same time.
No. Only in the tackle, that
speciality
was.
Speciality of the Cruyff
turn. I don't think you got sent off for us, did you?
I did, yes, once.
Go on.
I've got sent off
I just need to point this out. Adam Virgo, if you're listening.
Just the once.
He remembers getting sent off.
Yes, yeah. Go on then, George.
So the once for Brighton was Sonny Doncaster.
Right. Up there?
Up there, I think two yellow cards, I think it was, if I remember rightly.
Deservedly so.
First one was possibly a bit harsh, and then the second one, obviously being already booked, and then I think I tried to go for a tackle and miss, and I think I'd started walking before the ref got his red card.
So I think you know it. Yeah, fair enough. So.
Okay, well, moving on to present day then. You're now the interim manager of the Albion women's team, or is it the ladies' team? I'm never quite sure which one it's meant to be.
Yeah, women or ladies, I suppose, yes.
Now, so how did you get into women's football?
Well, women's and girls' football. So I suppose, obviously, I'm a qualified coach, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. So I do my coaching stuff, and then about, I think, 5 years ago, got invited down to what was then the Centre of Excellence for the Girls.
Where was that?
We were based then at Falmer.
Right.
So that was about 5 years, and so my Fandangle title was then and still is Technical Director.
Right. I think that's a pretty cool title.
Yeah. Not sure what it means, but it sounds great.
He's a director of techno.
Technical director for the girls, which is now called the RTC, Regional Talent Club.
Right.
So I've done that for 5 years. And then, obviously, the backdrop to me being the interim manager was, obviously, the first team women got promoted. Oh, sorry, before the promotion.
Well, they won their
league.
Yes.
And then they had to play in the playoffs.
Uh-huh.
But obviously before the playoff took place, the first team manager and the general manager both got the sack.
Mm. So when you were doing your technical directing stuff, obviously you had to work with the then manager and the then sort of director.
Yes.
So what has all sort of like fandangledness aside, what does your role as a technical director actually envisage?
So I have to oversee the the programme in relation to what the girls or how the girls train. So we have from under 10s up to under 16s, so we've got four age groups. And within that, we have two coaches per age group. So I have to oversee what they do and try and mentor them. And obviously within that, the quality of our coaching will then be passed down to the girls. Mm-hmm. And then obviously liaise with our DS manager as well, because obviously that's where...
So, I mean, since you've... I mean, you've been involved in the women's side for, what, 5 years, you're saying?
Yes.
So, I mean, in that time, there's... Did you see an uptake of more girls wanting to do it after the last World Cup, for instance, where
England did very well, didn't they?
Brilliantly well.
Yeah, yes. Oh, yeah, I think that every year it's got bigger and better. Obviously, with England doing well in the World Cups, obviously helped that. And obviously for us being a Tier 1 club as well and our facilities, so we obviously train at the training ground as well as the boys' academy and obviously the boys and the men's DS and first team. So in that environment, I mean, it's who wouldn't want to play football?
Just to rewind a second, when you walk into that training ground and you see the facilities there, do you think, Christ, if we had this when I was playing?
Oh, yeah, without a shadow of that. I mean, as I say, I was a player here at Brighton, and you remember the days of when it was blowing a gale up at Falmer.
Yeah. Did you, when you were going
past the dog mess, or, you know.
Yes, yes.
I mean, did you actually recognise that there was actually grass on the pitch?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the facilities at the training ground are second to none, and, yeah, I'm sure it is an honour when you walk in there every morning or whatever time you get there to go in and work. And I mean, actually to be a player there now must be fantastic.
So when you had the ladies' team won their Southern Division title, effectively, I suppose, for want of a better term, sort of the Division 3 South, because you've above them you've got the Women's Super League, which they're finally sort of getting into line sort of in time for, you know, you had the Super League was in the summer and everyone else was in the winter, which is absolutely ridiculous. So it's a little bit of a mess, but I think it's finally realigning itself. So you obviously were familiar with the team and how they were operating when they won the division, and then when James was asked to leave, and you were asked to take on. I mean, was it much of a gear crunch for you to you know take on this particular, even if it was just as a you know a, well at the time a one off?
It wasn't. I mean, the obviously the main difficulty at that time was just the initial fallout from the sackings, if you like. So there was a calming down period. So we just need to make sure.
Was there consternation amongst the squad then?
For one or two, there was.
Yeah,
because there was quite a big gap between winning the title and actually when the playoff game was, wasn't there?
So in hindsight, that worked out really well for us. To be fair,
In order to actually sort of realign things.
So there was a definite cooling off period of for people to decide whether they were with the club or without or not with the club. Mm. Once that was decided, then from that day on, it was full steam ahead and on we go to the playoffs. So.
No, I went to Wickham that day. Lovely sunny day.
Lovely day.
Yeah, talk us through that because, well, all I can say is I thought Brighton, I was about to say the Albion because the other team was the Albion as well.
Yes.
I thought the Albion was superb, but from a manager's point of view, you talk us through the day.
I mean, manager, not being funny, for me it was quite easy. I think it was, I just had to facilitate the squad really and just emphasise how well the girls had done previously, and I just had to manage that and make sure that everyone was positive because they could play.
You know, so you're kind of more of a motivator rather than a technical sort of tactician?
I can be that, but I think on that particular occasion it was just, well, just have a look at what you've done previously. If we can go out and do that, then you'll win the game. It wasn't a great shakes of a team talk or whatever, and obviously the night before we watched... I think it was the European Cup final, wasn't it? I think, which went to penalties. So, again, that helped the situation. So, we were all bonded together that much longer and stuff. So, yeah, I was very confident that we were going to win.
Assisted by Amy Merricks.
Yeah, assisted by Amy.
Tell us about Amy.
Yeah, Amy, a fantastic coach, and she's obviously started out on her A licence, of which I'm sure she'll be passing. So, I was ably assisted, so... As I say, for me, there was never a doubt that we were going to win it, even though we went 1-0 down.
Sure. So for those, I mean, there are some people who are a little bit sniffy about women's football. They, you know, it's not the same game. It's not this. It's not that. It's, you know, for me, to have anyone that's going to be there representing Brighton and Hove Albion with the famous stripes and the seagull badge, and for me, I think it's vital and so important, whether it's the women's team or the disabled, you know, the wheelchair team or the amputee team or whoever it might be. So let me ask you, what would you say to people who might sort of have this sort of reluctant attitude to watching women's football? What would you say to them about sort of, you know, getting involved or coming down to watch?
Well, I would say first and foremost, you have to come and watch it to pass your judgment. I don't think you can just say, oh, actually, women's football's no good if you haven't actually physically seen a live game. So certainly first and foremost, come down and hopefully you'll be pleasantly surprised with the talent that's on the show, especially in our side that we've got at the moment, and hopefully
and recruiting someone like Emma Byrne, who's been there, seen her, done everything in the game with Arsenal, for instance, that's massive.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, that was a bit of a coup, and I think with the help of a couple of people along the way, so to get Emma involved was fantastic for the club.
Now the girls are involved in the Women's Super League 2, which is effectively, I suppose, the equivalent of the Championship.
Yes.
What do you feel the chances are? I mean, I know as a manager, you've got to be sort of a bit careful. You don't want to overplay or underplay. But, you know, how what's your assessment of the rest of the division and where the Albion will fit into that?
Well, I mean, to be fair, we played 3 league games in this spring series, of which obviously we've drawn all 3. Mm-hmm. So initial thoughts would be we certainly look like we'd be able to hold our own. So. Mm-hmm.
There's a learning curve going on there, yeah?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I think there's a learning curve for the girls, and it'd be interesting to see once the spring series is finished, obviously, how well we do in that. Then what I'm saying now might be completely different. But
because one thing that springs to mind is that in last year's Women's FA Cup, Brighton played a WSL 2 side, Oxford.
Oh, yeah, 10-0,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously we played Oxford this year and drew against them, so I think last year they...
Well, Oxford obviously improved then.
Well, I think it was a combination. Yep, Oxford have improved. But I think we were actually into our league then. I think they were only a week or two back into their right. pre-season. So.
Sure. And is there plans to have another game at the Amex?
I'm sure there will be, yeah. I'm sure that there is plans for that to happen.
I mean, I was saying, you are the interim manager. I mean, yes. Obviously, sir, for you at the moment, the future is slightly, a little bit unknown. In terms of the role that you have currently?
Oh, well, my role currently is interim, and I've already said that, obviously, because of my own outside activities, that, and obviously I mentioned about my counselling, which the course runs every Sunday, so hence the reason why I've counted myself out, because I know that I won't be able to do it if I'm looking to do my diploma. Mm-hmm. So hence the reason why when the spring series is finished, then... I'll hand the baton over to someone else.
So there is another West Ham football fullback who's a women's manager, isn't it? Julian Dix.
He was, yeah.
Julian is he not anymore?
No. He's one of the first team coaches for the men's side for the last 18 months now.
He's had a promotion, yeah.
So
what does it mean? You know, I always ask this question of players anyway, but as a player, what does it mean for George Parris, albeit sort of 20 years ago, to have been an Albion player? And I'm going to ask this now also. What does it mean for you now to be, well, the technical director and the women's team's manager? I mean, what does it mean to you?
I mean, of course, for me, I mean, that's what an achievement, I think, if you look at what's happened in between times as well. I mean, if someone obviously said, sitting there now talking about what I've done the last 20 years... and said, well, actually, you'll still be involved in football and you'll be interim manager and you'll be technical director of Brighton. No, I'll say you're joking. So, I'm honoured. I say, for me to go in there every day is fantastic, and long may that continue.
And finally, when you signed for Brighton in 95, did you still think you'd still be here now?
Oh, no, definitely not. No, of course not. No.
It's not an unbroken period, is it?
No, it's not at all. But, I mean, that is actually all we've got time for. So thank you so much to George Parris for coming
thanks,
in.
Mate. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Good luck to the women's team. And you can check out all their fixtures on the Albion website. You're away next week, isn't it?
We've got Villa on Sunday.
And I know you just announced Doncaster Bells is coming up. That's the biggest name in women's football in the UK, for sure.
Apart from Arsenal, I think it's just Doncaster were there first. But yes. Yeah.
But thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. We'll see you again next week. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Paris, quand un amour fleurit, ça fait pendant des semaines deux cœurs qui sourient, tout ça parce qu'ils s'aiment à Paris. Au printemps, sur les toits, les girouettes tournent et font les coquettes avec le premier vent qui passe indifférent, nonchalant. Car le vent, quand il vient à Paris, n'a plus qu'un seul souci, c'est d'aller musarder dans tous les beaux quartiers de Paris. Le soleil, qui est son vieux copain, est aussi de la fête, et comme de collégiens, ils s'en vont en goguette dans Paris. Et la main dans la main, ils vont sans se frapper, regardant en chemin si Paris a changé. Il y a toujours...